The title is really Artists Talk About Their Artwork, not about artists. We're going to talk about ourselves. I guess when I first arrived and I hadn't seen Katie for 10 years since we were both here in the art capacity 10 years ago, and we got talking so fast about where we were at, how we'd grown in our artwork, how it affected us as women, the role we were playing as wives, mothers, so on, that it seemed like we felt that we'd like to share some of this with you, and it would make up a good discussion or talk. So the other thing is we did put up our artwork, Julie, who's just come in, has a big art show in Seattle, so she doesn't have her artwork with her to put up, but we'll talk also on her point of view and where she feels she's at now. So we're really decided the way to approach this was we'd each take 5 minutes, approximately, and just tell our own story, so to speak, and kind of tell you a little bit about ourselves and where we feel, how we feel we approach our artwork and our artwork means to us. And I thought I will start first. And I'll start with today then and work backwards. I don't know which chronologically to do it. I guess on your readers and resumes you're supposed to start with today. Where are you at? I really feel at this stage that I now have a visual language that I feel has matured, and I think I feel sure of myself and my artwork that as I look back I can see that I didn't have years back, that I was often apologizing for myself, explaining, wasn't quite sure, even though I thought at the time I guess I was. I can look back and see that it was about 4 or 5 years, and I can almost say at Holden, that my artwork took a leap, and I feel that I really sort of changed my language. It developed faster, and there was really a growth pattern. Colors were brighter. I developed a technique that has this sort of vitality and this energy. And I hope as looking at my paintings, you don't just see the poppies, but you see some of the brushstroke that's in it and the energy that I feel that it shows up in my work and the vitality. Some people, this is something that shows up in their work. Someone else, it might be the calmness, the well-organized part of it. We all have something a little different that we see and that we are showing and sharing with you. Our response to nature, to the world. I still like to use natural forms. I love painting outdoors and relating to the subject matter. And I will paint in front of the subject matter, establish the forms, and establish the feel of where I want to place them and how I'm going to solve this spatial problem, which is what an artist is working with, the spatial problem on this paper. Then I will often find I pick up colors, I pick up feelings of motion that's in the nature that I see in front of me, and then I'll start painting, and I often have found I haven't maybe looked at what I'm painting for 20, 30 minutes, and I almost have to laugh that I could be anywhere else. But I still sort of enjoy being in the environment and referring back to it and feeling the sort of the excitement of the objects that I'm referring to. So I'm innovating, I'm abstracting, I'm playing with the forms right there on the spot, and I can refer back if I want to find little clues on color, clues on light and dark and shadow that are appearing in the, that are right there as long as you're outdoors sitting there. I still enjoy being in the environment, and a lot of painters, I do paint in a studio too, and I really had second thoughts of how my painting would go at Holden, because years ago I came and had my little pad and ran around and did lots of landscapes and loved the mountains, and maybe I had to work that out because I think they're pretty overwhelming and gigantic, and you find that it's so powerful that you are sort of drawn to try to respond to it, and you find yourself sort of copying it. And I really feel that all creation nature is crying out to be taken as reference and to be recreated, or to be to have an artist digest it sort of and respond to it. And then what he does with these visual forms on paper, canvas, whatever it is his own personal process. and whether the technique plays in. As I said, I've gotten into this shorter brush stroke and a very brush stroke that has vitality. Sometimes it's short and long and as contrast with a lot of big open spaces. Your technique has part of it, the way you respond to the forms and where you put the forms, part of it too. I can remember coming to Holden for the first time to say how I've grown and my vision of what I'm painting now has changed. I remember just thinking the rhythmic, I saw such a rhythm in the mountains of the different lines that you all see in the mountains where the erosion and the different areas of the trees that I just couldn't, that this is what I was responding to and this is what I wanted to paint. Now when I come, I'm on this visual thing of the flowers, which I've done since about 1974, and I don't respond to the mountains and what I did respond to before. I'm in a completely different thing, and I'm doing a different type of painting. They say I've been working in a studio now in Minneapolis, and I really had second thoughts whether I could really paint outdoors again. But I know over the winter, about March and April, after painting indoors and learning how to do variations of other paintings. I took one painting of lilies and I did about 8 variations of it. And it would be like musicians doing variations of a theme, changing colors, changing arrangements, but very spontaneously. I paint very intuitively and spontaneously. I don't sit down and calculate and precisely draw in forms, which might be someone else's direction. And that's their approach. I love the watercolor medium because it does lead you into things. You have to accept things that happen. Often colors aren't just the way you mix them. The paper might absorb them, the moisture. But I like the medium because it is so fluid, it is so immediate. You have to accept things that happen, and you also can pick up, you can play with it well and innovate with it. Accepting what's happened and you let it lead you, so to speak. And then, although you're always in control. Well, I'm sort of rambling on. It's easier to talk than I thought. Now, where do I go back on? We may bounce back and forth as we tell the story, too. To reach back, I many times get people asking, oh, when did you start painting? And I say, well, this is where our stories may vary a little bit. I really can't remember any time that I wasn't painting or drawing. As a child, made paper dolls like everybody else. And I did do a lot of artwork in high school and did a big athletic mural, you know, and all that. And I did major in art in college, even though I was highly recommended and almost pressured into taking home economics. And I was of an era where... and I think I bought it too, where... the pressures were on you as a woman and a girl to make your preparations for marriage in the home. And but I went ahead with my art career, and I did teach for a couple of years in a private girls' school where I taught kindergarten through 12th grade, which was plenty challenging, a lot of variety. And then I did teach at the University of Minnesota during a time when their art department was going through a change, and I was an instructor and took my master's in art education. And I really hadn't expected to stay on there longer, and then I was married, and give you a little biographical material. I think I wove my artwork in and out of my changing roles as wife and mother, and I think it's a period of life, too, when a woman's energies are just, priorities take over, and you often just don't have the energy to give all I can. But I did try to keep my artwork up, where I know a lot of people who really faced it, gave it up, and then just came back to it. And I felt that it was necessary for me, and I needed this. And I took my days of painting, got my babysitter, took my little brown bag, and went off to classes where I could get critiques on my painting. And I talked to Kay, there were often times when those were discouraging days, and what you did wasn't that wonderful. Where everybody would give you remarks, must be such fun to paint, must make you so happy. Nobody could ever realize why you did it if it didn't make you deliriously happy, because this is supposed to be something you do just for fun. So it was hard to even tell yourself. In fact, I began to wonder myself, maybe I should have gone bowling and gone out to lunch or better use the babysitter money. when you didn't see the results and you were, came home frustrated and you weren't often accomplishing that much. But anyway, it was my choice to stick to it. And I said to you, often wonder why you pick up something like this. It's almost like you took a vow. Why did I keep painting? Why did I keep doing this? I will say I kept entering juried shows, and I was in enough juried shows to feel that the encouragement. I had studied before I was married at Cranbrook Academy in Art one summer, and at Taos one summer. And these were summers, too, where I saw a leap when you concentrate on your effort. Well, I forgot to watch my watch. we were going to get on a little bit, maybe this will bounce back and forth, too. Let's say I've, in the recent years, been in national juried shows. I've kept up one-woman shows throughout the years. And but I'll say it's just since this last maturing of my artwork that I felt really more professional, and that I felt my own friends and other people have accepted me as professional. And I don't know whether some of that is whether it's hard to take, society in general does not take art as seriously as other subjects, and whether then a woman in art is not taken seriously. Because it's such a nice hobby and thing to do on the side, and it's not very controversial for me to go out and do my artwork. I didn't go out and take a big job. But what kind of floored me, I'll just tell you a little story of a very good friend of ours, a very successful man, and a very kind man. And we've gone on ski trips with him and dinner parties, although we haven't known him that much in depth. I was at an art opening invited by the Art Institute in Minneapolis, where I have paintings in their friend shop, and I now am in four different good galleries in Minneapolis and showing. And he came up to me and he said, "Betty, I knew you dabbled, but I didn't know you were serious about art." Just floored me. Of course, couldn't wait till I got back to my studio and I share it with another woman painter, and we discussed this. And of course, that word dabbler really cut. But I just wondered how his attitudes had been formed, and we could go on talking about this too, of whether my own projection of myself as an artist did this, or whether this was society and other people not taking it serious until you get to a level where you are recognized by galleries and other institutions. Then the prestige starts to dawn on them and they accept it. Okay, my story. You watch the one. We're each going to tell a story, then we'd like to have you ask questions, or we might pick up things each other brought.
Okay. Give me the watch.
I talk too long. I'll stop you. Someone else should watch it, really. It's hard to.
Okay. Yeah, I guess one of the reasons I thought of thinking about being willing to talk today is that art has such a, in some ways, it seems so distant from people's lives. People think of it as folly, or as dabbling, or as something they're afraid of. I know a lot of people just, first of all, say, "Oh, I can't paint, I can't draw, and I don't know anything about art." And I want, you know, we all look, and really, art is a way of looking. So it's really not so scary, and I guess one of the reasons that I wanted for us to talk a little bit is to share the unscariness of it. I was an English major in school 15 years ago, and was that because I thought it was a practical thing to do, that, you know, one could teach English, and I love literature. I wanted to learn it, but then I thought, okay, to have something clear and concrete. I didn't think of myself as a creative writer, but as a transmitter of information, or bringing people to learn about literature. And just, well, this January I started graduate school at University of Iowa, and my mother came to visit a year ago, and I was telling her of my plans to start school. This is with three children. It's an awkward time in my life, I suppose, to do it. And she said, in absolute amazement, she's a wonderful, dear, little old lady, and really spunky, "Oh, but I didn't know you liked art." And that was really shocking to me, because even though I never sort of put it in capital letters, I always worked. And then her next response was, "Oh, but Well, not immediately, but after she digested it. Next time she came to visit, she said, you know, I feel so badly because we didn't do anything for you. We didn't help you as a child. And it was so nice to be able to say to her, but Mom had always brought home paper from the office. There was always paper, and he was very frugal about things, but this office paper was clearly, I could have as much as I wanted of it, and I didn't have to save it. And I always got color crayons, and I always used them. And the second thing that I had as a child, besides the color crayons and paper, was that my parents were a good deal older than I am, and I was an only child, and they kind of had their life. And I was left alone a lot. Not abandoned, but simply left alone to my own wiles, to dream and to fiddle around and to sit in trees and make things in bushes and go places in my head. And I guess I've always liked that best of all. I've liked colors and lines and being alone. And about 3 years ago, well, 2 years ago, I guess it was, I got, if anyone's read passages, I suppose there's supposed to be some time in a person's life where you make decisions about what you're doing. And I did, in fact. After having worked, always been an undercover artist, always working, more or less extensively, but we traveled a whole lot. My life, in a way, followed Harold's career a little bit, where he was in school, but wherever we stopped, I would take classes, or I would just go to classes, just be there, even if I weren't taking them for credit, and talk the instructor into letting me stay and draw from the model. So I really like working with figures. And I decided 2 years ago to stop this nonsense of saying, well, I'm just kind of going to do it, but to really do it. And I think the barrier had been that it didn't seem like a very practical thing to do or a proper thing to do, and that one almost had to say, oh yes, but to say you're an artist, you had to say, I'm good. I mean, you can say you're a plumber, and no one asks you if you're a good plumber or not. It just happens to be how you spend your time. And in a way, I'm wanting to say that as an artist, or as a painter, or as someone who works with these materials, that I don't want to have to give you my qualifications before I make something. That at some time after I've made enough, you'll be able to judge whether it has any substance or not. But that I have, in fact, every right in the world if I can work it out financially, which is just a tremendous trick, I tell you. I mean, if you're single or if you have children, it's just a real trick to be able to find the money to buy materials or the space to work. But if you can do that, you have the right to do it. Why in the world should you sell life insurance? I mean, is that so much better than spending your life with colors and silence? And as I, you know, as I claim that gift for myself, or that privilege, or that life, I want that to be for whoever else wants it also. I mean, it's not, I don't want it to be a hierarchy, really. I simply want it to be an alternative. Mm-hmm. And some people really like color and line and space relationships and silence. And some people really make tremendously good mechanics or orators or, you know, politicians. There are places for people. Okay, I really am sort of talking without a plan. I gotta come back. But then what happens as I spend time in this silence and color? Well, I was talking to Jack a little bit today about what is working. And what I would say is that what comes down, I had a show last fall too, and I was supposed to write up what my work was about. It was a show of drawings in charcoal and graphite. And I wrote, you know, a good full yellow pad full of small writing, and finally whittled it down to this about, which is that for me, seeing and living is an encounter with what's out there. It's all of you, or it's the flowers, or it's the mountains, or it's an idea. And what be- becomes on paper is a record of that encounter. It's as if, you know, there's all of that and me, and we both have some active force that come together and, you know, become something like that. Well, the work that I've done here is a rather lighthearted encounter. I've been working mostly in some pastels, some color, but mostly charcoal and graphite. And here, the atmosphere of Golden Village, not only the smell of the pine in the mountains, but the kind of conviviality, the way that when you walk past people, they give you back rubs a lot of times, and you cry and hug at the bus, and that all really affects what's happening to me. And when I'm working, I work long hours in a studio alone, and simply, or in a classroom too, now that I'm in school, and just work and draw. But here there's a lot more people contact, so that what I've done here has been a response partly to that delight in, and then delight in the colors. The poppies really got me too. I tried, those poppies. Oh, I did some, we had one very foggy day, and I'm a little apologetic for these scenes because they have a history of what I've seen in the history of art too. I mean, what I put down comes from who I am, and who I am is everything I've seen. You know, it's the way I learned to walk, and it's the way what I've seen in museums, and I think that I've borrowed a vision in a way from people in the Orient who painted cloudy landscapes. I'm afraid that's happened, but I did it anyway, and I put it up for there for you to see it. But anyway, I don't know. That's about all I have to say, except that this work is. It's a glowing in this delicious color and the wind in it and the patterns of the leaves. All of those things come, but you don't think about them when you do them really so much. You've got the colors there, you put them in, work in watercolor. It's funny having worked in black and white for so long to have just the deliciousness of that color. It's really fun. It's fun, but that sounds bad because it's not just jolly. This particular experience has been very nice because it's so sensuous or sensual. Which one do I want to say?
Both.
Yes, okay. Put them both together. But there are times that I will work all day long and come home in a wretched mood. And Harold, who is up there someplace, really understands a lot about what this is all about, still says, but why do you do it if it makes you so unhappy? And it makes you unhappy, I guess, because you haven't resolved it. There's something there that hasn't gotten finished being done. The encounter hasn't been really explored, or you've done it shoddily. You know, you've said things in a stupid way. I mean, sometimes you really do stupid things on paper, and you feel trite and shallow, and you know that there's something else there, and it's just tremendously, you know, discouraging, and it takes your mind away, and you don't talk to anybody, you just keep thinking of these things, and you go back, and some things work out and some don't work out. It's a funny process that you go through, but this particular experience has been generally just mostly in the senses, and therefore very, very nice to have done. Okay, I'm done.
I want to say again that I hope before everybody leaves that they will go around and look at Betty's and Katie's work, because that's the best way to know, I think, in some ways what artists do. And look at their work, and it's interesting, I think, because they're both working with flowers, and they do very different things with them. And it's kind of, I think it's interesting to see what interests them specifically there. And I wish I had some work along, but I don't. I'll just say that I'm a realist painter. Paint a lot of houses in cities, and I also paint fields and other landscaping things, and it's pretty big, and I paint with oil paint on canvas, and I paint with oil paint on paper. I think that making art is really silly sometimes. When I work all day in my studio. I kind of like a banker. I mean, I go up there at a certain time in the morning, and I stay all day. and then I come down. And I have very few mountaintop experiences when I'm in there, and a lot of the things that happen aren't any good, and I get irritated, and then sometimes something happens that I really like, feel related to, but sometimes it occurs to me that this is a silly thing for a grown-up to do. And I really fight that whenever I have that thought. Because I think that what Betty was saying a little bit, there is an attitude somehow that art, particularly if it's art by living people, is frivolous. Once you're dead, it becomes extremely serious and expensive. But somehow that if you're an intelligent, competent adult, and yet you spend your whole day basically making marks when you could maybe be saving society or something like that. Those thoughts do occur to me, but not too often. I found out that it isn't very romantic at all to be a painter. I think that I started to be a painter out of a very romantic feeling. When I was a child, I went through wanting to be a spy, a ballet dancer, the great American novelist, an actress, and a great journalist who would hopefully cover wars and be flown in. I had enormously romantic fantasies of what I wanted to do. And then I got married. I married a man who had 3 children and then had 2 more, and romanticism was somehow, it was real life in some way. So I didn't start painting until fairly late, as those things go. I went back to art school when I was 29. I'm 38 now. And we had 5 kids, and the youngest one was 1. And I went back to school full time. And I didn't know anything. I'd been painting for a few years at home. I'd stay up all night and I made little pictures. And I'd always spend enough time in museums to know that they weren't any good, probably. But an artist friend suggested that maybe I should learn something since I wanted to spend all this time. So I did that, and I went to school for 3.5, 4 years. All day, and since I had a degree already, I didn't have to take other courses, so I just painted and drew in school. And when that was ended for me, I was clear about the fact that that's what I was going to do with my time. I was going to make pictures of some kind or other. And then the struggle came to keep doing that. I think women, in particular, women who work at home, if your studio is in your home, and mine was, our children, we had small children, and we didn't have money to rent something somewhere else. There are an awful lot of things that need to be done. And you have a lot of bad days where no idea has come to you, and you can't make the picture work. And in that encounter that Katie talked about, which really strikes me as being an accurate description of that, I think, in that encounter, you're coming off second best. With the idea, with the vision, with the world, whatever you're doing, you come off second best, and it's very discouraging. And when you know about art history and you know all these people who made all these great things, you realize, you're really coming off second best, and you realize the floor needs to be scrubbed and the toilet needs to be cleaned, and there are all these little household tasks.
And the kids are out of socks. You really should go out and get
dressed. Oh, and get socks, yes, and because the paint you're buying, right, means he didn't have as much meat. There are all of those things, I think, go through your head. And the thing for me when I got out of school and was working full time at home in the studio was to stay up there and work. It's so easy for that to become a hobby. And you have to work, or that's what it becomes. It becomes a pastime, which is a fine pastime. But that's not what I wanted. And so that struggle that first year was that one. Just staying up there and working when all these other things needed to be done. And now it's been enough time for me that I think that I can say confidently that I'm a painter, and that's what I do, and I expect to be doing that for a good long time. And one of the things I was thinking about before tonight was trying to think about what interests me about what I'm painting, why am I doing it? And I came to the conclusion that one of the reasons that I paint, a real strong reason, is that I think it's the way that I listen to myself. that I'm trying to describe my world just for me, and I think it's a pretty egocentric activity that I'm into. But that somehow, my experiences, and particularly my experiences of seeing, come together for me when I'm painting. And the way I think, I think about the world and about what's around me and about the way I fit into it, is somehow in those paintings, although I think it's totally irrelevant whether the viewer knows that or not when they look at my paintings. I don't mean to imply that. But it is for me, that's a real important factor about what I'm doing. If I were in another art form, I'm pretty sure I'd be a writer. I think I'd write something. Because it's a form of describing my experience to me really strongly. And it's also a sheer experience with color and shape. And I just want to say one more thing about art. And that is that I think that I run into so many people who are intimidated by art, particularly if it isn't representational, particularly if it's abstract. There's somehow a feeling that you're supposed to get something from that and you aren't getting it, and it's way over your head, or you can't comment. There's a whole aura about art that I think a lot of people feel put off by. And so I just want to state my belief that paintings, sculptures, prints are, first of all, they are objects. They're objects like this chair and my coat and the fireplace. I mean, they're another object. Whether they are about poppies or mountains or people or about lines crisscrossing in funny ways, they, first of all, that's what they are, and someone has decided they want to play with that. Then I think those things are other things as well. But I just think that's helpful to think about art that way first. And that's it.
Well, I just want to add to that then, that I describe what the encounter is of what God outside comes to you and you meet it. Well, as you approach something, it's the same sort of thing. One encounters what you look at. It has a certain life to it, although it's an object. I mean, it does have a life. Mm-hmm. Objects aren't not living. I mean, there's a lot happening in those stones. And if you let it come to you, let it see, and you come to it, you bring it something, your history, your thoughts. And it might fall dead, it might be boring, and it might not be very good, you might not have the kind of experience that will allow you to look at it. But at least what you can do is give it the chance to meet it and have it meet you.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Yeah, maybe it's a visual language, and I'd like to do it. When Ledbetter sat down and someone asked how he created his poetry, he said, "No, it just comes." And I thought, well, I'd like to just say it just comes too, because it's hard to explain. And whenever an artist is asked to interpret their own paintings, and this has gotten to be an art in itself, you can go to the galleries and the language it's gotten into is really fantastic. You don't know what they said by the time they get done. But I think this trying to, and the art historians really struggle because they haven't painted, and they're always asking artists now, what did you go through? How did you do this? It's a visual language and it should be looked at. And we shouldn't even be talking. It should just really be looked at. And I think that we are a little, I should almost say, illiterate in our visual senses. We're such a reading, that's visual too, I mean in an artistic way. But we're reading, hearing, and now TV visual watching, but not creatively and imaginatively, really looking. When I've had people say, gee, you must see things differently, and I thought, well, I never thought I saw them any differently. It's just the encounter again, or what I decide
well,
to put
do
it down.
You see them differently.
But evidently do. Yeah, I've trained myself to see them differently.
But so will Julie, so will I, so will you.
Yeah.
I mean, all around the room, we're sitting in different chairs, and our eyeballs are you know, and your eyeballs are never going to be where mine are at the same time. And just that difference, and the very history that we have different, we're going to bring something different to how we see. And that makes painting
some people play. See it as art, and others, can it be art to some people, but not to others?
Right.
How universal is
it? Well, I think you're using the word art, though, as a value term. I think we're using art as painting, sculpture, prints, visual making of things, and not implying that that's good or bad.
That's a good question, though.
But
you
I know
what
you
are their standards.
Yeah.
Are you saying that are there black and white standards that
well,
you can say this is art and this
art.
Isn't, this is
you're
isn't.
Implying by being an artist that you're good at what you do.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I don't want to imply.
Well,
I'd like to. Okay, let me
that
stand
isn't why
paper.
We went
that
into
help?
It in the first place that we thought we were good at.
See, that's the dangerous thing. I can't do that. Somebody else is going to have to do that for me. I have to give myself to the time and the space and the color and the lines. And if I worried about whether it was good, I mean, if I finally said, you know, is it going to be as good as Rembrandt? Is it going to be Picasso? I might kill myself. I mean, artists do it. It's a high suicide rate in the art world because people ask that question too often. And I think it's an important question. And I suppose artists also think of it, but it can be very paralyzing. You almost have to say, all right, do it, and let your time now and future time decide. And the time now is very fickle. The people who say, you know, something is good right now has to do with, here's an example. If Joe Schmedley did a show and a dealer in New York, say a big dealer, liked it and bought or suggested he have the show in his gallery, and if somebody else who had a lot of money said, I think I'm going to sponsor this person and bought the show, that person's work, no matter what it was, would escalate in value. I mean, the art market now is a stupid sort of thing. Not necessarily to do with the quality of the work, but because someone who's prestigious and buys good art would buy that show.
Is that what you meant?
and so that I, you know, I don't know if anyone's going to, you know, pick Katie Schurston out of Davenport, Iowa, and, you know, make me a millionaire. I'm not sure that I'd want it, and I'd like to have enough money to buy all the paint I want. But, you know, yeah. I won't answer that question.
I'm going to say there isn't good or bad art. There's art that has more depth to it, more richness to it. There's art that has more color.
I make judgments.
That has more statements.
I certainly do.
Well, I make judgments, but I finally, but I finally won't make the end, the art.
I won't make the end either, but I would answer your question, but yes, I'm implying I'm good at what I do. Mm-hmm. I think I'm implying that by the fact that I spend 7 hours or more a day doing it and have done.
You didn't know your
No, no, when I start, well, and I wasn't. Mm-hmm. I mean, I started for some other reason because I had no reason, believe me. I mean, I was not any kind of, you know, Swift prodigy thing, you know, woo, wow. I mean, nothing like that. I made a lot of bad things. They were, I mean, anyone would say, what a bad picture, right? And that's the way I started. And so I was doing it for some other reason. But as time has gone on now, it's been several years. And the fact that I am, you know, I'm rational and so forth, that I spend the bulk of my waking hours doing this is obviously an implication that I think it's good in some terms. I think it's worth doing.
I agree with that.
And I would definitely say that. In terms of any final judgment, well, I mean, I can't make that, or and I don't know, you know, other people make it, viewers make it, whatever. I'm not very concerned about that.
Okay. But it has value and it's credible.
Yeah, I certainly am implying.
But you're
that.
Not going to hang it on the wall and say, here's my dumb painting.
No, I won't.
That's
exactly, of course not.
Yeah.
No, I throw, I whip
things
up.
That's not implication, that's just plain saying it.
Oh, yes, I'd say it all the time.
You bet.
It's a confidence in yourself that this is what you should do and that this has value to you, but not an ego that you think you're the world's greatest,
like
but it's that it's worthwhile to do.
I come in for that, too.
Right, applause. I love applause.
You're darn right.
You bet. I had a show in Seattle recently, and there are, you know, several few critics. Anyway, one particular critic I think is a total cretin. Okay, I mean, I really do think I don't think he knows very much about art, but he said nice things about my show. And let me tell you, even if the guy you think he's a cretin, if he says nice things, he has risen in my estimation in a bizarre, strange way. And I would also say that if he would have said nasty things, that would have been solace to me to say, well, that jerk doesn't know. But I would have hated it nonetheless. That you don't like to see ugly things about yourself in print. But that's an interest. Yes, I certainly applaud.
Well, then paint and put them all in a closet. Certainly,
I mean, you
do it. It'd be like singing in a closet. I think somebody who didn't really go out and contribute or feel like they wanted to share or feel like it was worth. It has to be seen. Yeah, you don't produce art to not have it seen. That's the other side. I think it has to be, there has to be a viewer, really.
A teacher said that was a final, point of the creative act, was that it was viewed. He had a whole lot of steps of what it was, but that it wasn't complete until it had been seen.
And philosophically, you can say that, and if someone buys it, takes it, and it has a new life, you've done your part, and it becomes something different to the person who buys it and looks at it every day, and it takes off into another area.
Yeah, you really
which
have
is kind of
goal
exciting.
Work when it goes away from you.
And it can be precious. Some people don't want to, you know, this preciousness. No, you make it, it's appreciated, it goes, it has a new life.
I think visual artists are fortunate over other artists, for example, actors, dancers, musicians, although to some of what of a lesser extent you can play a flute alone, but that we can make our art fine alone. And it's very frustrating if you can never have it seen, but most artists work for long periods of time before showing. But I think, boy, actors and dancers, you know, have to have a stage.
They've got to have a committee.
And other people, and there's, you know, and I think it's more difficult.
And then our performance is after the fact. The show, the work is already done. You've gone through the whole creative process. You're off from it. Or the performer, the art, the dancer and all that, the performance is then.
Yeah, I know.
Of course, they say if the mistake is done, it's then. And ours is after the fact. By the time you see it, it's after the fact. You know. Which
is
nice.
Is there a time when an artist sets out deliberately to communicate something, and where the personal experience may have become so internally overwhelming that he just says, I want to show people who are looking at this something?
Oh, sure.
I think that I can remember being terribly annoyed by the Pop Art movement, for example, you know, the Campbell Soup Camp. And I looked at it and I thought, yeah, God, it's someone putting me on. You know, I could take a picture of that and maybe make it more important.
But that brought your attention to Campbell Soup Camp.
Yeah.
I want more Campbell.
But I began to gather that. I'm sure if he's trying to unveil something about the culture in which we live in terms of.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, some of them were, certainly some of them were, but they were more, the pop artists were more interested in reacting against a movement that had come right before abstract expressionism, which was an extremely emotional, romantic, abstract painting that was heavily grounded in a lot of psychology, particularly Carl Jung, in which the idea was that one paints from the gut, you know, and there were some really beautiful, energetic things made. And there were a lot of things that I don't think have held up very well. But the point was, that took over the art world for about 10 years. I mean, that was it. Everybody worked that way. And the pop artists were, in many ways, a reaction against that kind of what they would call enormous self-indulgence, and were saying that art is anything at all. Anything is a subject, and they were, I think, making fun of the culture.
You
but
act of vengeance against
a fellow
artist.
Well, not so. No reaction against a movement that had held sway. I mean, art
not against individuals,
no.
But about something that had happened in the world. But I guess I hold with this idea of encounter, that one can encounter an idea, and that an idea can be done badly. It can be done blatantly. I saw a lot of things done in the 60s that were war protest art. Done by people with big names.
Yep.
And they were so involved with what they were trying to say that they said it badly. And so there is value, you know, you make value judgments. If you have an idea, it has to have gone somehow through you, so it holds up in your commitment to what you're saying and to the beauty in how you say it. And there is something to talk about beauty in this,
mm-hmm.
too.
I think Goya, when he made a lot of etchings, but the disasters of war, which are absolutely, you know, terrifying to view, and certainly have an idea, and he did it beautifully, and it's all correct, but a powerful reaction he had to a situation which he wanted to communicate. There's just
but
a great deal.
The German
expressionists
in the 30s were reacting really strongly to a climate and did it well.
But then the good and bad of it is, like you said, it can be done poorly, or when the art values behind it are the strong point, then the commentary comes over and they become works of art. the Expressionists were a strong school of painting, and they were the, well, their own art values, their own means of painting were strong and good, plus their commentary of what they were trying to say.
Well, I want to throw in something, and I don't know if you made this clear. I mean, Julie just sort of, when she gave her background of working hard for three, four years, just doing things that weren't very beautiful. But she studied, and she drew, and she looked. And Betty, in the background she's had, has worked. And it's not as if any of us have just sort of picked this up and said, oh, tra-la, that I'm more and more, and this is just something I'm coming to also, that in its reaction against American art very much, and American art of the 50s, the abstract expressionist got thing, is that there's a whole lot of learning that goes in looking. I mean, learning, if you're going to draw a figure, you know, or have any idea of a figure, you really better learn how a shoulder, an arm goes into a shoulder, and how a nose comes out of a face. Those are real problems, and so the kind of drawings that come from that are renderings, you call them. You don't have really an idea. You're doing incredible studies, and you build up your vocabulary, you build up your ability to see, and as you get adept at doing your craft, then the ideas that are a part of you are able to use that vocabulary you've built mm-hmm. up to form something else. And I guess that's something we didn't say, but you do develop like a tool.
Yeah, here's one yeah. here too. Yeah.
Yeah, it's often tempting when we get an artist in the corner to kind of have the artist speak on behalf of all of art.
Yeah.
And I'm hearing some of that happening.
Yeah, too much.
It seems like the more sensible course would be to listen to what these artists are saying about what their work mm-hmm. is. What I'm hearing is a Giacometti kind of statement. We often have a feeling, the layperson often feels like it's show and tell, like the artist was showing from A to B and says, this is what I saw, get it? I think it's more Giacometti, where Giacometti is saying, I don't draw ahead to make a piece of art, I draw ahead to figure out how I see ahead.
Right.
Okay?
Yeah.
So I hear these people saying, the encounter, words like that are hitting me, and I'm hearing them say, this is what's happening, I'm trying to figure out how I see these things. Okay? And when you view it, you come along for the trip and see if it strikes you that way too. If it doesn't, you reject it. And you say, no, that doesn't make any sense to me, I didn't see it that way. Or, yes, I can see that now that you pointed it out to me, thanks a lot. It's like when somebody, I'm walking with someone and I see a sunset, and I say, gee, look at the sunset, and they say to me, wow, thanks, I would have missed it. You say, that's the artist. thank you, I would have missed it. I didn't see that about poppies. I learned something new about poppies by your encounter and you're sharing it with me, rather than the kind of thing where we get off on this trip like, wow, our artist got to fool me, or am I getting what they're trying to tell me? I'm not really sure these artists are trying to tell us anything. I think they're trying to talk to themselves in a kind of private personal way up there in the studio with a lot of material and a lot of time. And then we just look at it and say yes or no. I think they're trying to see how they see, develop that vocabulary of how to see, and then the rest of it happens.
And it's problem solving. That we told you it's discouraging, and there are the bad days, but boy, there are the good days when that problem's solved. You can have some really, really, I can get high on it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't need anything else either.
Yeah.
And it's terrific. And it's like a scientist, I'm sure, or a musician, or anybody. The minute everything gels and comes together right, boy, you know it, and it feels great. And you can't always describe it or explain it.
I would want to respond, though, to Gary. I think that looking, though, at art, not just mine, I mean, looking at art in general, and seeing something, and so forth, all of that is true, and I would wish people would become a little more confident of their vision. Okay. But I also think that one can learn to see, just as one learns to read and learns to listen. And I don't think we really learn to see very well. I think that when you think of the level of our reading ability as compared to our visual ability, in America, people read rather complicated literature quite easily, but are visually almost, what's the word, illiterate. I don't want to call it ill-visioned. Okay. And there is a learning, I think. I mean, there's a learning of a visual language. I think just seeing, going and looking a lot, I think that's important.
Well, just looking is a creative
just look,
act.
Yeah.
The preparation, that's obviously what gets an artist off when he puts in 40 hours making a painting. He has to spend 15 minutes and thinks he's doing a real favor and says, no thanks.
Yeah, and but Oh, wait, I have it here.
Okay, I was thinking of it. Or to even look at a painting and ask yourself, what is this artist's visual language, maybe, and try to answer it.
Oh, I know what I was going to say, is that we see functionally, when we're little, we're really taught to view the world as something we can manage and get around. And that's why I think I brought in just the delight in color for its own sake, and the ability to be alone and not do something consequential. We're really sort of primed to make usable products, yeah. And our eyes are taught, well, and we do have to learn, you know, we recognize that as a fire and it's hot, and you know, we know this is hard stone, we walk around it. We have to be functional in our vision. Except that that's limiting our spirit. Yeah, throw that one in. Because we're not just functional creatures. What in the world are we good for, really?
If we're born
to die to just get something done. And there's something about taking a lot of what is here in too, being inconsequential. I recommend that to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Is it possible that possibly isn't the purpose of art? To expand people's visions that maybe do not have that insight. And so the artist that does have that insight that has spent the time learning how to look is helping other people learn how to look.
Can I tell you a story? It's a really little story, and it's an adaptation of an old, I think it's an Aesop fable, but it's a story about some mice who lived in a wall, and were used to living by a farm where they could get grain from the farmer's barn, but the farmer moved away, so they had to work all summer. And there was one mouse named Frederick, and when these little mice were hustling, getting berries and things, Frederick was just kind of sitting around the fields, and they'd say, Frederick, what are you doing? And he said, well, I'm gathering sun for a cold day. And the next, you know, in the book, well, it's Frederick, you know, we're really working hard. Well, I'm gathering colors. And then, you know, Frederick, he's really a lazy bum. Well, I'm putting words, I'm getting words. And in the story, the mice eat up all their food over the winter, and they're cold and they're lonely. And they say, okay, Frederick, all these things that you collected, you know, what are you going to do with them? And so Frederick started talking about the sun, and he really made the mice believe the sun was there. They felt the sun. They experienced the sun that they knew, but they hadn't stopped to think about. And then he described the colors of the poppies, and the book really did have poppies in the field. And then made a poem about the season. Frederick was a poet. And I mean, that's maybe being simplified, but...
How is that different from propaganda?
It's another forum.
We're not at that point yet.
Yeah, that's another forum.
That's if you want to get that one, come at 9:45 or what? 9 o'clock.
9 o'clock. Yeah.
I think it's different from propaganda because I don't think the artist knows.
Should I respond?
Yeah, go ahead.
I don't think the artist really knows how her vision is going to be transmitted. I don't. I'm not certain how someone else is going to view my work. I really like leaving a lot of things open in it. It's one of the things I'm interested in, is not describing too much. I'm interested in people being able to play in it. And propaganda, it seems to me, has a real clear directive.
It's manipulative. Yeah.
Although what's really interesting is that a lot of art, and what we call art too, that's been done in history, has been designed as propaganda.
I know, but it failed, I think, which is why.
I don't know if it failed. I mean, I don't know how it worked in the Arena Chapel. I don't know if it got the people.
But those were great pieces of artwork too.
I mean, they were art by themselves, even though they were done for propaganda, right. And that's kind of interesting. But that was the times. Each time has their own way of working too.
Well, it's like Bertolt Brecht's plays, which he designed as propaganda, but failed usually. And so they became good theater. They didn't just come out that way. They transcended that.
Usually propaganda
is failed as propaganda.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they failed as propaganda and really became theater. He didn't want to have theater. He was always trying to do things that would be non-theatrical, and they're the most theatrical things in the world.
Well, they work as ideas too. No.
Oh, I mean, as ideas.
But as teaching devices about something too.
Maybe we could say it could be propaganda as long as it's a good piece of artwork. Now you're back to good.
Subject
matter does not make the artwork.
The design
and the use of shape and space and the problems. But if you add subject matter and you still have a good piece of artwork, then it could be. But it won't stand up alone on just subject matter, propaganda, use, or...
I think all of you have used the term art.
Yeah.
And I guess I still have a problem with, I guess, the value judgment of the term art. I could look at that log and say, that's art.
It's a log.
Say that's a lot too. I probably wouldn't.
Well, I think we're saying, first of all, that visual art is created by people. That would be the first thing I would say about it.
I don't feel like I've had my question yet. How universal does something have to be called art? Is it art to one individual? And is that enough? Is it art to the artist?
I think it's universal because art does exist in all form, shapes, beginnings of society. Our man has always expressed himself in visual terms, whether it was on his tools or on a cave wall or anything. And so there is a universality.
Let me ask it a different way. How good does it have to be given the label art?
Doesn't have to be good to be labeled art. I mean, I said before, and that term, we're all using the term art to mean visual things that are visual made things. Okay. I think there's good art and bad art and mediocre art. And I make judgments about it. And there's a great deal of controversy about that. There are some people who think that really you can't make any kind of decision at all about whether it's good or not. I don't think that, but I mean that there are some people that really do believe that, and you know, big-ass poncho art people who think that too. I mean, so there's some real controversy about that question.
Especially now. Yeah.
Yeah. That anything, finally, that someone makes, if the person decides, and I want to make this, then that's valuable, and is we can't make a judgment about that, whether that's good or bad. But the art is making, I think.
There's still value in it, but I don't know.
In some ways, it's an artificial term, like literature.
This way, in a way, it's more comfortable to say painting.
That's good.
That you're a painter.
Yeah.
You use the word painter.
Yeah, I'm more comfortable with that.
I have a friend that says...
A drawer is hard to say. I'm a drawer? No.
Yeah. And one friend
said,
he never says he's an artist, Michelangelo. Only a few people like that were artists. That's really reserved for the real.
Yeah, you know,
we're all painters, and time will judge.
Materials. Our cautious justifiably. It's just that somehow you sort of give into it as an alternative to drawer.
Some children are fantastic artists. They seem to have a natural sense of design, which they lose, but we don't consider them the finished product of. Many adult artists try to recapture this because there is this freshness and delight. So you don't say one's good or bad, but it's a certain... And then there's such diversity in art. In fact, we live in a very exciting time because there is so much diversity and individuality. But we always have... critics and commentators are always saying this is the narrow view you should look at, or people who reject things will say this is what I think it is. Instead, it's a time of diversity. There are many different artists with many different directions, sites. This is what's refreshing and exciting about it. And when you see different kinds of art, enjoy the diversity and learn how to enjoy some kind that maybe you rejected before.
Or make
and
a
look, like you
yourself,
said.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I make a word new band, and I look at something that's supposed to be good, and it doesn't do the thing.
Well, that's what I said about where you are and where it is, and that you may or not mesh with it, and it may not be good
In our values,
I think
there's
really crummy things going around that are worth that people pay money for. So there's a lot of relativity in the judgment. Things in history plays a lot.
Ages, too. There are a lot of things in museums that are there only because they are old.
Yeah.
They were done at a certain period, and it isn't necessarily bad. I mean, they're there because it's representative of a certain period in art, So it has an educational value.
Right. We got a Rembrandt, but it was something he never would have maybe even let out of the house.
Rembrandt had things that weren't so, you know, always so good.
Manet
has
done some dreadful things.
And Hay
in Chicago, the art institute,
but
the art.
The
one
on the
Institute.
Yeah.
But you can
still learn
from it.
Yeah, there's a bunch of
bad
work there, I
think.
I mean,
yeah.
I've got a question. I'm kind of curious to know whether you think that you maybe or possibly sacrificed any of your visions or any techniques or ways you would like to show the things you paint. Whether you sacrifice any of your own techniques or any of your own methods of showing what you're painting in order to, you know, to please, you know, to please or to feel strongly accepted, which I know.
I mean, you paint a certain way because you're good.
Whether you paint a certain way to think that, or to, whether you paint a certain way to make people accept your work because you know that isn't accepted.
Mm-hmm. I sure hope I never do that, but I think that's a real danger. Mm-hmm. It's especially a danger.
There's a term called potboilers. You're going to paint a potboiler, and that's a pain that sells, that you feel for an average person who
but sometimes you do that unconsciously, too.
Yeah,
I think there's a danger
in that, because I've been to several shows and been to and talked to several artists and see how they pretty much mass-produce ideas, you know, and then people consider them... Sometimes we're considered very, very good artists, but yet they're not really showing they're capitalizing on what people want.
Especially if you're successful. I think that's the real danger, to keep repeating.
But it's like anything in any other field. I think we like to end on your point of learning to look, and we just invite you to be curious, look, and stretch your looking. Thank you.